being mindful is really important once you're done on the water. So checking all of your equipment, all your nets, fishing gear, hosing down the sides of your boat is important. And then for the boat bunk itself, unfortunately, it's pretty tricky to get in there. And so to play it safe for now, I would say if you've been in an area that you know is infested with giant sylvania and you want to take your boat somewhere else, I would recommend waiting actually a week between boat trips in order to really make sure those plants are dead.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Working in the Weeds, a podcast from the UF IFA Center for Aquatic and Invasive Plants. My name is Jay Farrell. I'm your host, and I have my co-host, Christine Krebs.
Hi, everybody.
So, Christine, tell everybody what we're talking about today.
So a lot of you in our listener survey shared an interest in learning about the research going on here at the center. And at the same time, we saw the research setup for this study that we're going to talk about today on giant salvinia. And it's super interesting. We have Karina Villake here, also known as CJ. She's one of our research biologists out here at the center. And she kind of ran this study. And so we want to kind of learn more about it with her and kind of recount the setup and the impacts of this research on giant salvinia.
CJ, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm super happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. So you're not from Florida. So how did you end up at the University of Florida doing research?
So I'm originally from upstate New York, and I've always been super passionate about the environment, plants. As a kid, I would go wading into ponds and collect little jars of things to come back and look at. And for my undergrad degree, I went to University of Florida for a degree in plant science with a specialization in plant breeding and genetics. I graduated in 2021, and after that, I took a little break from the research world. I worked in industry for a year or so before realizing it wasn't for me, and then I ended up coming back to academia here at the Center for Aquatic and Invasive Plants. So I've been working for Dr. Ben Sperry for about a year and a half now as the lab manager, which I've been really enjoying. And I actually started grad school this fall semester, which has been super exciting for me.
You study plant science and plant breeding. You started your job here at the center. Why are you doing aquatic plant research? What was interesting about the job posting when you saw it initially?
Well, I've always been super interested in the environment and ecology and growing plants, and it seemed like a perfect way to integrate all my interests. I get to do the fun part of going out into ponds and collecting things and also be working towards something that I really care about, because invasive plants are a super big problem for our ecology, especially in Florida. So it feels great to be working towards something that can really make a difference.
Well, I remember when you came to the center, you were really sort of hired just to manage plants in the greenhouse and just do some of the really rudimentary things, but quickly observed that you had a real knack for research, so it got you more and more involved in different research projects. And we want to talk about one of those today, dealing with giant salvinia. So it's not a new plant in the U.S. It's somewhat of a new plant in Florida, but kind of tell us about what is giant salvinia and a little bit about this project you've been working on.
Yeah, so giant salvinia is a floating aquatic fern. Its scientific name is Salvinia molesta, and it's actually a super interesting and unique looking plant. It has these fronds that it grows that are kind of half circle shapes, and they have a really interesting texture. They're kind of spongy and hairy. So it is a fern that floats on top of the water. It's originally native to Brazil and was introduced to the U.S. in the 1960s and spread around through the aquarium trade and pond hobbyists. But unfortunately, it is extremely invasive to the southern United States, and it's actually on the federal noxious weed list, so it's illegal to transport between states. And if some of you are out there Googling this plant right now, you might see a photo of it and think, oh my gosh, I've seen this in the pond in my backyard. I've seen this in my aquarium. It's everywhere. And I want to make the distinction up front that there is a similar plant that is a different species called Salvinia minima. So the bad one we're talking about is Salvinia molesta. Minima is also not native here. However, it is already established in Florida, and it's not a huge management concern. It has a smaller growth form and isn't as invasive. So molesta being not yet established here in Florida is a major concern, specifically in prevention.
Well, we want to talk about the difference in those two a little bit, but you mentioned a couple of times that this is a floating fern, and that is a real important distinction to understand about this plant, because ferns don't make seed. They don't flower and make seed. So they really just put all of their energy into making leaf tissue. So the growth rates on these aquatic ferns are just unparalleled.
Yeah, for sure. So this floating aquatic fern doesn't even produce viable spores. It actually only reproduces vegetatively. And it's been known to double in size in only 4 days, which is super quickly. And in terms of the difference between Minima and Molesta, one thing is just the size and invasiveness of it. But if you really want to tell the difference, if you're out there in your backyard looking at a retention pond out there, I really recommend getting a magnifying glass and taking a look at the trichomes or hairs growing on the leaves. The giant salvinia will have hairs that actually grow up and curve together at the tip, kind of like an egg beater type shape, whereas the Minima will have trichomes that go straight outward. So that's the main difference for telling them apart.
Yeah, and there's a couple of other things to think about. So Minima and Molesta, they both sort of like slow-moving, sluggish water that seems to be lower in pH. So we kind of see them in aged ponds that are sort of protected, that have a lot of that detritus in them and pine needles from years and years that have pulled that pH down. So we don't really see them a lot in high-flow type systems or in big lakes with a lot of wave action. They don't seem to like that. But the big difference between the common salvinia and the giant salvinia, the Minima and Molesta, is that Minima, you're going to see it everywhere. You see it driving down the road. You see it in retention ponds. You see it all over the place. But it usually just sort of forms a single layer on the water. So it is smaller, but not always. You've got the trichome differences, the leaf hair differences, but usually that the Minima is only going to make that single layer, so it doesn't cause the problems that Molesta does. So talk about how that Molesta is going to grow and some of the things it does when it's just turned loose.
Yeah, for sure. So Molesta is unique in that it doesn't just grow horizontally to cover the surface of the water, but it will also grow upward into these thick mats, which can grow to be even a meter thick. So these can be really problematic. So if you're thinking about out there in a water body, such as a pond, so when it covers the entire water surface, which it does quickly, that has its own impact because the sunlight can no longer reach submerged aquatic plants like Vallisneria. So those plants will die off, causing decreased dissolved oxygen levels, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners are aware, and that can cause fish kills. So it pushes out our native vegetation that way. And then it also, when it starts to grow upward into these mats, can cause huge problems with human use of the areas. So boating, fishing, and swimming in areas, it can be a lot more difficult with these big mats in the way, and just utility of water bodies. If it's an irrigation intake or hydropower reservoir, it can be a huge problem.
Yeah. So if you start to see that, oh, that's just salvinia, but it's starting to stack up and looking bigger and just looks a little different, we need to go investigate what that is to see if that is the old-fashioned common salvinia that we've dealt with for years that we rarely manage that can be problematic, or is it this new one that we really need to be on the watch out for? Because this thing is, it's already been found in how many states?
It's been reported in 13 states so far. The main ones being Texas and Louisiana are where the worst infestations are. And here in Florida, it's been detected multiple times, but thankfully hasn't been fully established yet. And this is due to rapid response and eradication efforts on multiple fronts from different groups working on it, and also just citizens reporting it so everyone can stay on top of it.
And so far, I believe I checked some maps this morning that it seems to be primarily detected in the panhandle. So there is a location way out in Escambia County, which is Pensacola. There's an area in Gadsden County, which is right around Tallahassee. There's a new infestation in Jacksonville that we'll talk about later, but we don't seem to be picking it up down in the peninsula or in South Florida. I'm really concerned if it got in the canals down there, but so far, fingers crossed, we're not seeing it in deep South Florida. But you're right, and Louisiana, in Texas, it is already well established, causing huge, huge, huge issues. In Louisiana in particular, it is their number one problem, hard stop, period. There is not a number two problem plant in that state.
And so we talk about the rapid response and detection and these management efforts when they do find this plant. What are some control methods that they use to manage giant salvinia? So it's a floating aquatic fern. How does that impact management efforts? What do they kind of do with the plant?
So herbicides are an important method of control, although it can be kind of tricky because of those trichomes I mentioned. So you really need a good surfactant and appropriate herbicide to really get down in there to affect the plant. And it's important to catch it early and consistently, because if you wait too long and it gets to that tertiary growth stage where it's forming these thick mats, it can be really tricky because you can kill off the top layer with herbicide, but you have all these layers of giant salvinia underneath that could grow back.
Meanwhile, it's doubling every 4 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea that the hairs kind of impact whether the herbicide is even impacting the plant, and then also the fact that it doubles so quickly, it's like you got to stay on top of it.
Yeah. It's definitely important to catch it early, and prevention is the main thing we're looking at right now in Florida in terms of controlling.
So when you have these big mats, what about mechanical control? Can you go in there and just harvest it out?
Mechanical control can be an important component to an integrated management system for sure, but it's definitely tricky because this plant reproduces mainly vegetatively. If you miss just a couple of those little fern fronds, they can float away and then create whole new stands really quickly.
And like I said earlier, it seems to like that sluggish water. So it's usually in really shallow areas that are going to be hard to access with a harvester.
And we had a trip recently to Texas and saw the giant salvinia in these sort of swampier areas. And I couldn't imagine bringing a harvester into those areas where those cypress knees are, right? So those slower moving waters, even in those swampier areas that have the shallow water, but also those cypress knees, I don't know how you would be able to do it with something like that.
Yeah, so it is part of a solution, but it is not going to be the solution. But the biocontrol angle does seem to be making some progress.
Yeah, the biocontrol angle is super interesting. It's something I don't know a lot about, but it seems like there's a weevil that eats giant salvinia that they're doing research on right now in terms of combining that with herbicide control as well. And that can be a really important component to a management system, especially like we're saying in these cypress knees and areas that are difficult to reach for applicators. It can be a great part of control in those areas.
Dr. Rodrigo Diaz at LSU has been doing a lot of work in finding that beetle and really understanding how it works. Dr. Chris Mudge with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Louisiana is also working with it. What they're finding is the weevil can be quite effective, but the one that they have is not real cold tolerant. So it is working well in South Louisiana, but as you move into northern climates, or even northern Louisiana, it doesn't seem to want to survive all winter long. So you have to reintroduce them every year. So you reintroduce them, and about the time they get to the population that you really need, they're doing a lot of good. It's starting to get cold and they slow down again. So we've got the harvesting option. We've got the biocontrols that are working for us, but you're going to have to augment with herbicides. But to your earlier point, the best thing to do is never have the problem to begin with, is to prevent it before you ever start. So that is sort of the idea behind the project you've been running, is really focusing on prevention. So talk about what you've done and what the angle is for this study.
Yeah, so our study is really looking at prevention methods, and it's attacking it from multiple angles. So it's not just what we can do as researchers or scientists in preventing the spread of giant salvinia, but regular people who are boating, what can they do to help? And so that's what our study is looking into specifically, is how giant salvinia can be spread by boat. So for example, say you're from Florida and you're on a boat trip in Texas or Louisiana, and there's giant salvinia in the water. Eventually, you're going to pull your boat out of the water and come back to Florida. And then maybe within a week or so, you put your boat back in the water in Florida. And so what we're looking at is, can giant salvinia survive that? Can it actually hitchhike on your boat or your boat bunk and then survive and reproduce and cause an outbreak here in Florida?
And this is really important to understand, because this plant is super spongy and it lives in the water, but we have also seen it live on land for quite some time. So when you have up and down water, what you can see is the water will come up, it'll start moving the giant salvinia further up into the system. Then as the water retreats, a lot of that giant salvinia will be stranded up there. But it is so spongy, and often you have this big mat, it just protects itself and it stays wet in that mat for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it can live on dry land as just this big sponge for a very long time until the water comes back up and floats it back out. So this is why you're concerned about, can it survive underneath that boat?
It's a very interesting and impressive plant in how it can survive, but it's also super concerning. So that's what we're looking at here.
And so what was the setup? Because if you're a boater or you're out in the water, you know that when you take your boat out with the trailer, inevitably you're going to get some plants stuck at the bottom and you want to trail away with it. And the most appropriate thing to do is to kind of clear off those plants to kind of prevent what you called aquatic hitchhiking. So how did you set up this study? Did you have a row of boats? I remember seeing it at the center facility and thinking this is a very interesting setup. So can you describe it a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, so we didn't use actual boats, but we did have representations of boats in boat bunks. So our boats were actually 250-gallon tubs filled with water. Like, if you know what cattle often drink out of, it's this big tub filled with water. So that's what we use for our boats. And the reason it's filled with water is just to add that weight that's easy to move back and forth throughout the study so we can check on the plants. So we can pump the weight in and out instead of lifting bricks. So those were our boats. And then we also have boat bunks underneath. So we have these planks with different materials. So we had plastic, wood, and carpet to represent the different kinds of materials that people could have.
So those are the rails that a boat will come up on and sit on the trailer.
Yes, exactly.
And you had different material because one person may have a wood base, others may have spent a little bit more money and went ahead and got that plastic sort of base. And so you wanted to look across the board, all the different types of products available. What is the difference? Is there a difference?
Yeah, we really want to get information out to boaters about what they're doing and how they can help specific to them.
All right, so you've got your boat bunks, you've got your simulated boat on top, adding the weight down onto the plants. So where do you go from there?
So in our setup, we take giant salvinia, we have very specific weight out amounts that we use for our reps, put those on the bunks, and then we put the boat on top, fill it with water. And so then we're actually crushing these plants for certain time intervals. So we checked on them at a half day, 1 day, 2 days, all the way up to 16 days of being crushed to see how that's impacting them.
And that crushed part is important because in the real life scenario, the boat is on top of the plant and you're riding around with it and you may not get back in your boat until like maybe 2 weeks later.
Right. This is something that's actually real. So if you've got tournaments in the summer and you've got an angler that's going to a tournament in North Carolina, then they're back in Florida the very next weekend, then they're in Alabama. All of these states, the Carolinas, Alabama, they have active populations that are really not under eradication like we are in Florida. So it's very possible you could pick these plants up. And since they can survive on dry land, are we bringing them back?
So what if, for example, at 4 days of being crushed, you have a group that looks like it's kind of alive, but what if it's actually damaged to the point that if it was released to another water body, it wouldn't be able to survive? So after you've had these plants crushed for different time intervals, how do you kind of find out whether the plant is alive or dead?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. That was something we kind of had to figure out as we went along. And so to say a plant is alive, I basically gave it like any chance, like if there was any chance at all that I could see it growing back. So if it had any green left on it, any structure, if it wasn't completely brown and wilted, we would give it a chance. And by giving it a chance, what I mean by that is we actually have a recovery greenhouse, which is a bunch of little pots of water set out. So we will have each group that is alive or even a little bit alive will be assigned a recovery pot to put in to see how it grows. So we'll place it in there and then monitor it every day or so to see, is it getting bigger? Has it died? What day did it die? And also weighing it at the stages along the way.
So we're nursing it back to health.
Well, we're letting it do its thing and see what it does. I don't think we're necessarily trying to help them out here.
And so how long did you guys decide to like cut off that sort of recovery time? So you put the plant into the recovery bucket. How many days of a chance did it get?
If 7 days after being in recovery, it was still alive, we just called it. And then we also weighed it before and after it was placed into recovery. So we can see actually, did it decrease in mass? So was it slowly dying and it just took a long time? But we actually had a lot that increased in mass and were growing and actually thriving after being crushed in that recovery greenhouse.
So about 7 days gave you a good enough idea of what was going on with the plants.
Yeah, I'd say it gave us a good idea.
All right, so 7 days of recovery was enough to know. Okay, so now how long does it take the plants to actually die when they're on the different boat bunks? I mean, I'm looking for some good news here. I hope you're going to say it's really, really quick.
So it wasn't very quick, unfortunately. The longest amount of time that we had a group survive was actually 8 days of being crushed. But thankfully, that group seemed to be kind of a fluke. It didn't go on to reproduce and thrive after. But the concerning thing is that we had many, many groups survive and thrive after being crushed for 4 days.
Now, was this done in the middle of summer where it was super hot? Was it done in the fall when we're getting cool nights?
This was done in the summer. So June, July, August, we had two runs of the study going on throughout the summer.
So when those plants are going to be really growing and going crazy in the field is when we were trying to understand what is the likelihood of moving them.
Yeah, so seeing like what's the worst case scenario. But it would also be interesting to repeat the study during different times of the year to see how that would impact their survivability as well.
Yeah, especially like in Florida, where boating recreation happens pretty much year round versus other areas in the United States where boating kind of slows down a little bit when it cools off.
Okay, so 4 days, they were pretty well surviving across the board. But did you see a difference between if it was a carpet bunk, if it was a plastic bunk? Did that matter?
Yeah, so we haven't done statistical analysis yet, so I can't give you an exact answer, but I can tell you some of my preliminary observations. And it does appear that they survive for a little bit longer on the plastic boat bunks rather than the wood or carpet. And we think this is because of moisture retention, because if you're thinking about carpet or wood, it has a lot of dry surface area, which can suck out the moisture from the plants, whereas plastic really doesn't have that. So it contains a lot more moisture and allows the plants to survive for longer.
All right. So from what you sort of know and what you've observed in this experiment, kind of lay out what's a best management practice scenario. So if you've got somebody who is going to be in going to a tournament in an area that we know is hot with Salvinia, what would you recommend that they think about and do?
So being mindful is really important once you're done on the water. So checking all of your equipment, all your nets, fishing gear, hosing down the sides of your boat is important. And then for the boat bunk itself, unfortunately, it's pretty tricky to get in there. And so to play it safe for now, I would say if you've been in an area that you know is infested with giant Salvinia and you want to take your boat somewhere else, I would recommend waiting actually a week between boat trips in order to really make sure those plants are dead.
And we probably ought to also put in, inspect that boat ramp before you put your trailer in there to know what you have. Because if you are seeing these plants floating around, your risk just goes way up. It's not going to say that if you don't see any, there's none there. But if you see them, you really need to take extra special care. Now, speaking of taking care, what does the University of Florida do to make sure these plants don't escape? So we're doing research on them, and the last thing we want is the next population to be found right here next to the center. So how are you guys protecting Gainesville from this plant?
Yeah, that's a good question, and we take that very seriously. So we have our giant Salvinia stock in its own specific greenhouse where we don't really do work with other plants. It's just for this plant. It's our like lockdown greenhouse. And when we do studies on giant Salvinia, we make sure that it's an enclosed area. So for example, for our boat bunk study, we had to use more of an outdoor area in order to get the full setup going, but we actually put nets over any exposed giant Salvinia and we weighed down those nets to make sure there was no escaping possibilities there.
Yeah, and not only are we taking those precautions, but when you say a lockdown greenhouse, it is literally a locked greenhouse. And we get inspected by a Florida Department of Plant Industry very regularly to make sure all of our procedures are in place. Now, when the plants are finished and it's time to dispose of them, how do you ensure that what you're disposing is actually dead material?
Good question. So this is something we encounter a lot in our invasive plant research. And so what we typically do when disposing of plants is we'll actually dry them out in these plant ovens for a few days until they are completely dead and dehydrated. And once that's done, we will actually put them in trash bags and take them out to the dumpster in Thai trash bags. So there's really no chance that there's going to be any surviving plants after that.
So there's a lot of things that go into research that don't always make it into the publication or make it into the glossy little brochure. So there's a lot of care that has to be taken on the front end and doing the experiment right, doing the statistics right, but then also what do you do with these plants after the fact? So a lot of moving pieces.
And so with that, if you were to run this study again, or maybe you will be running this study again, what are some things you would change?
So I would add maybe more time intervals to check on the giant salvinia. As I said, we checked on them at a half day, 1 day, 2 day, 4 days, 8 days, and then 16 days. And we saw that almost all of them survived 4 days, but almost none of them survived 8 days. So I'm wondering, when is it in between then? Does it really die? Is it 5 days, 7 days? It would be good to narrow that down to get a more specific recommendation to our boaters out there, because right now I'm saying probably a week, but it would be nice to have something more specific to recommend.
That's a good point, because if they take their boat out Saturday or Sunday and they know that they can just wait 4 or 5 days until the next weekend, that might be great news. Or, hey, we might have to skip a weekend because I'm not really sure if I have giant salvinia on my trailer or not.
And in October when it's not as hot, or March when it's not as hot, does that change? So that would be a nice little interesting piece to add as well. So it's never going to end. You're just going to run this for the rest of your career.
Yeah, pretty much.
Over and over and over again. Okay, so this all being said, the threat of this plant is real. And if you have seen it in Louisiana and Texas, it is very clear that this is one we don't want here. That is why Florida FWC is so aggressive. Every time we find this plant, they swing into action with early detection, rapid response, trying to stamp this thing out as quickly as we can. But we've just had another flare-up. I believe the most recent was in Jacksonville. So tell us what you know about that location and what's going on in Jacksonville right now.
Yeah, so this is actually a very recent and developing issue in Jacksonville that's just come to light over the past couple of months. They found giant salvinia overtaking an entire retention pond there, and actually has a drainage vent in the pond that is flowing into a creek that flows into the St. John's River. So this has the potential to be a huge problem, or something that gets cleaned up really quickly. We're kind of in the stage right now where we're not really sure. So it's currently being tackled by multiple different groups, multiple different angles. There's groups in Jacksonville right now who are putting barriers out to prevent it from flowing to different areas into the river. And they're also doing herbicide treatments, not only foliarly, but also in water to really tackle this issue.
So with that, the St. John's is a really interesting river because it comes from central Florida and exits into the Atlantic Ocean. And there is different levels of brackish water, different times of year. So are you guys trying to address any of those issues about that's unique to the St. John's? Because we don't want it in the St. John's River.
Yeah, so that's our role here at CAPE in Gainesville. We are looking into doing some salinity studies to see if we can expect the escaping giant salvinia to survive at all in the St. John's River. And I will actually be going up there tomorrow to take water samples to test them for salinity levels, pH levels, and then based on those results, I'm planning to design a study to see if it can survive in those conditions.
Excellent. So guys, we just want to make sure everybody is aware. This is, like I said earlier, this is a plant we don't want. And if you see some salvinia that just looks a little different, please take a closer look. And if you don't feel that you're skilled enough to really understand what you're looking at, grab these samples and contact someone at your local county extension office, someone at the university, someone in Department of Agriculture, someone at FWC, someone who has knowledge of this plant, because we really need to know if there's a new hotspot showing up. And since there was a pretty big population in Jacksonville, it might show up in multiple places now. Now, if they do see it, so we've talked about talking to somebody, what are their other options for trying to get the word out if this thing is observed somewhere?
Yeah, so there's a site called EDMAPS, EDD Maps. Christine, do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, so there's a website and an app. And so I find the app probably a little bit more convenient, especially if you're out in the field and you can report it that way, right? So this is a citizen science app where you can log on and share your sighting of the plant, take a picture of it, and then it The GPS tells you the coordinates, the location's documented on a map. And then researchers actually use this app to then inform the distribution of certain plant populations. And I'm sure there's probably some sort of setting or alert right now for giant salvinia. When there is a new sighting reported on the app, someone is alerted. I don't know who that is. Maybe Chuck Bargeron, who we've had on here before, who does the apps and invasives. But it alerts the authorities that there has been a new sighting. And that's kind of how that citizen science relationship works out. And it's a convenient, again, like I said, a website or an app.
So that said, CJ, thank you for being with us today. Is there kind of a take-home message or something that you've learned in this process you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important to just be mindful out there and know that as a citizen who enjoys Florida's waters, you can make a difference. So just keep an eye out there. Anyone who is out there on the lake or looking at your pond or enjoying a creek in Florida, take a look at the water, see what you can find, see if there's anything suspicious out there, and just be mindful, especially when you're out there boating, to take a look and see what's in the water and if you need to take any precautions to prevent the spread.
And I think there's also a couple of other things to think about. This plant started in the aquarium trade because it's a really cool looking plant. Just be aware, a lot of these plants may not be good outside of your aquarium. So this plant is both on the state and federal list, so you really don't need to have it at all. So if you see it at some type of fair or some type of sell event, please don't take it. We don't need more of that even in aquariums because this is a bad actor. Secondly, we had a situation a few years ago. There was some folks in the St. Augustine area were visiting family in Louisiana. And I said, man, look at this really cool plant. And they brought some back with them completely unaware. So when you see plants that seem to be growing at a high level in a different state, let's leave those in a different state. We probably don't want those back in Florida unless we know exactly what they are. So don't be transporting plants unless you know what it is and you know how to maintain it and manage it back in your scenario.
Yeah, and if you come across something in your landscape, aquarium, backyard, pond, or lake, and you're not really sure what the plant is, take a picture of it and go visit your local extension office. They can help you identify what it is, let you know if it is invasive, or maybe it happens to be a native that you can then appreciate in your yard or your lakefront property. But we do have resources linked at the end of this episode. That includes our plant directory, which gives you some information, including pictures about the differences between giant salvinia and common salvinia. We also have a journal article cited from the biocontrol researchers that we mentioned before from LSU and the Army Corps of Engineers. CJ also recently wrote a blog about aquatic hitchhikers and the study. We have a post from her about the study on social media. You can really learn a lot from our resources about this study. And we honestly look forward to kind of having a follow-up episode in the future, how the salinity study is going, or if you really are doing some more intervals with the same sort of setup with the boat bunks. And with that, we really appreciate you all listening to this episode. If you have any questions or feedback for the podcast, you can email us at caip@ifas.ufl.edu. That's cape@ifas.ufl.edu. And listen in for the next episode as we continue to turn science into solutions.